Shrink Wrap Radio number 559, Restoring Resilience with Dr. Eileen Russell.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Dr. Eileen Russell, clinical psychologist and author of the 2015 book, Restoring Resilience, Discovering Your Client's Capacity for Healing. For more information about Dr. Eileen Russell, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Dr. Eileen Russell, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to have you on the show. And I want to congratulate you on your very comprehensive book, Restoring Resilience, Discovering Your Client's Capacity for Healing. Resilience is such a hot topic these days. And so I was immediately drawn to the title of your book and said, oh, I want to interview her about this book.
Thank you. Well, yeah. I'm glad you did.
Yeah. So before we get into your book, let's hear a bit of your backstory. Like, when did you first realize you wanted to be a psychotherapist?
When I always say when I was about 15, which I think is unusual.
Yeah, that's young.
I was just one of those kids that people seem to go to with their stuff and issues and problems, and people tended to trust me and open up, and I found those encounters meaningful and liked sharing with my friends as well. And I think I've been endlessly fascinated by human beings and how we work. And so it seemed kind of obvious to me, though I had no exposure to psychology until I got to college.
Yeah.
And everything I took just kind of confirmed that's what I wanted to do.
Well, that could be my story as well. So I think that's how many of us
drift. It's nice to figure it out young and not have to keep rethinking it throughout life. So
yeah, well, I'd never heard of psychology or psychotherapy or any of that before I was in college, I think. So did you end up majoring in psychology as an undergraduate?
I did. Yep. I majored in psychology. I pretty much knew I wanted to get a PhD, so I was kind of very focused in school, and needing to get to graduate school was the goal. So
Wow. And where did you end up going to graduate school?
I went to Fordham University in the Bronx.
Okay, good.
In New York City.
Uh-huh. And you've been working some time as a practitioner of AEDP, which stands for Accelerated Experiential Dynamic Psychotherapy. How did that come about?
It was very fortunate. I at the time that I was in graduate school, was in New York City, and most of the New York schools were either very strictly cognitive behaviorally oriented, or more likely they were kind of heavily psychoanalytically oriented. And so I went to a very eclectic program at Fordham that was like the scientist practitioner model, and they wanted to expose you to everything so that you kind of made an informed choice. Mm-hmm. And also thought about your approach scientifically, at least to some extent. So I felt I was drawn to the depth of psychoanalysis, but not drawn to how it seemed to be practiced at the time, and wasn't finding anything that felt like a real fit for me. And when I was on my psychology internship at Bellevue Hospital in my fifth year of the program, I met Dr. Diana Foscia, who's the founder of AEDP, who was really just beginning to develop AEDP at the time. It wasn't even called AEDP.
Uh-huh.
And I had the great fortune of being able to work with her in supervision once a week and videotape a case. And so it felt like where AEDP is, by its nature, I think, a pretty integrated and integrative psychotherapy approach. So it felt like it pulled on the different things I was exposed to and added to it. And it felt like a good fit for my personality, I think, as well.
Well, that's great. Sounds like you just made a beeline right to where you are today.
Yes.
Now, some of our listeners might not have heard of AEDP, so maybe you can tell us something about it in terms of the fundamental assumptions and what distinguishes it from other psychotherapeutic approaches.
Well, I think of AEDP as a pretty integrative, as I said, type form of psychotherapy. And it's kind of some fundamental assumptions are that it's focused really on healing and what healing looks like versus what pathology looks like, which is, I think, something most of us have more experience and immersion in. It's experiential in that we're kind of trying to facilitate people's having a corrective emotional experience versus simply just insight or just kind of a behavioral redoing to introduce new information.
Yeah.
What distinguishes it? Did I answer your first question?
I think you asked me pretty much. Let me follow up and sort of picking at the words of the name of it. Part of the name is accelerated.
Right.
So in what way, as opposed to what? And, you know, how fast is the acceleration?
Yeah, in my case, not very. And if I could drop any word, it would be that. We've kind of joked among the faculty and with Diana about changing it to, you know, affective experiential dynamic psychotherapy, but it's too late. So, but at the time, you know, Diana had trained in and done a lot of work in short-term dynamic psychotherapy, which was really meant to be 40 sessions or less.
Mm-hmm.
And so in, I think at the time of its birth, it was kind of in comparison to a traditional analytic treatment that would go on for many years, you know, 2 to 4 times a week. So the idea was that we were trying to get to that level of depth within a little bit of a faster time because we were intentionally going for accessing the body and accessing feelings and not just more of an intellectual approach or cognitive.
Yeah, I think often in people's excitement about developing a new approach that that they think it's going to go faster.
Right, then
somewhere down the line they discovered, well, yes. some of these people need a lot more attention.
A lot, right. Especially when it comes to trauma and relational trauma there's a lot of healing that needs to be done. So.
Right, and another part of the name is experiential. And again, I'll ask experiential as opposed to what? I'm playing dumb here. I mean,
I figured you must know the answer to this question. But I think, you know, experiential in the sense of, you know, we go back to a quote, or Alexander and French wrote an article in, I think, the 1950s. And they were coming from an analytic perspective, but where they talked about that the most healing and the most improvement happens when people have what they called a corrective emotional experience.
Yes.
So that it had to be kind of affectively rooted and that there's something about the work in the moment, you know, so, you know, kind of a development from Fritz Perls on in terms of, mm-hmm. what's happening in this moment right now? Do you notice that you're doing this with your hand? What's happening in your fists right now? You know, do you notice there are tears in your eyes? What's it like to hear that with me? So very much of an emphasis on what's happening in the moment.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm young enough to remember Fritz Perls and to have met him, seen him in person, to have fallen under his sway for a period of time, not totally, but a little bit. Mm-hmm. Now, as you mentioned, the founder of AEDP is Dr. Diana Foscia, and I actually interviewed her. So when I say I'm playing dumb, because I did interview her about 6 years ago, back in 2011, on another podcast series that I was doing then called Wise Counsel Podcast. And at the time, we discussed her book, The Transforming Power of Affect, A Model for Accelerated Change. Mm-hmm. So again, this was back in the days of acceleration.
Right.
Now, What led you to write your own book, and what distinguishes it from hers?
Well, actually, part of what led me to write it is that Diana did not want to write it. There was some, I think Norton, who published my book, actually approached her with some sense at the time that there was a lot of interest in the topic of resilience. And I think they had a sense that, and I'm not sure how, but that there was something about ADP that seemed like a good fit for resilience. And I think she had enough on her plate and wasn't interested. And I like to write actually a lot and was looking for opportunities to do some writing by which, you know, I was really thinking some articles, not a book.
Right.
But I was, you know, through my graduate school training and papers, and I've always been interested in and always was kind of studying aspects of resilience. So this felt like a good fit. And even though it didn't feel like the perfect time in my life, because I had young twins.
I had twins too. Wife and I had twins. Yeah.
Yes. And boy, girl, or?
Two boys, fraternal twins. They're now adults. So.
I have boy and girl twins, and they were quite little at the time, and they're still reasonably young. So it wasn't the best time, but which is partly why writing the book took as long as it did. But I also knew it was something that would hold my interest, and so that's kind of how it came about. And I think what distinguishes it from Diana's book is probably that it's really, I think of it as kind of a development on AEDP that, as I said, when I met Diana, she was developing AEDP, and then she kind of gave birth to this book in 2000. And in the 15 years between when her book was published and my book was published, we started an institute, and we have, you know, a number of faculty. I think we're now up to 21. So, so many different voices coming in, AEDP has expanded and grown, as I think one would hope any approach to psychotherapy or theory of psychotherapy does. So I think I just had some more to say. And I think I also had the benefit of, okay, we've all been doing this now for 15 or 20 years. What have we learned and how might we tweak things? And so I think that's part of it. And then some of my own concepts that are really based on having done it for many years and what my own reflections on the work and when it happens smoothly and when it doesn't happen smoothly.
Yeah. So you were really in on the ground floor and have been a kind of a co-developer, it sounds like.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, I think we all have a general sense of what's meant by the word resilience. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're trying to do a scholarly job, really sort of dug down into resilience and what that might mean. And you actually queried a number of your colleagues doing a little research on as to how they define it based on their own clinical experience. For our purposes here, how have you come to define resilience?
I always joke, it took me about 3 years into researching and writing it to come up with a definition that felt right to me, beyond Webster's, you know, the capacity to bounce back. I think of resilience as the self's, I define it as the self's differentiation between the self and that which is aversive to the self. So I imagine it almost like a cell. You know, if the self is a cell, and cells are always surrounded by membranes, that there's, even in very traumatized individuals, and I think this is kind of an existential positing of something I can't, you know, prove, but that there's a difference between the self and that which impedes on the self or opposes or threatens to annihilate. And so there's some place in us that is not damaged. And I think of that as resilience. The self's differentiation from that which is aversive. And I mean, you know, aversive in the sense of truly things like neglect and abuse, hatred, humiliation.
Okay. Like that. Okay. One interesting thing that you wrote, among many interesting things, is that resilience is not invulnerability. What was behind that assertion?
I think that, well, the, the term invulnerability, there was one of the first and most amazing pieces of research done on resilience, which was published in 1982, was Verner and Smith's Vulnerable but Invincible. And they were looking at children on the island of Kauai, who 700 children born in the year of 1955. It was an amazing, amazing study. They followed these kids for 18 years.
I don't know that study. Great.
Yeah,
go ahead.
That's the name of the book. It had to be a book because there was so much data to publish.
Yeah.
But they were looking at all of these risk factors for various types of psychopathology. And it was one of the first studies where that was happening. And they started to look at the patterns that didn't fit. You know, so here are a bunch of kids that either come from single parent homes, or where there's a parent who's has substance abuse, or where there's a parent who has a mental illness. They were all poor, actually, which was what made it's so interesting. All of the families on this island at the time were poor families, so they had that risk factor. And from that, they started to look at, well, what were the factors that predicted better adjustment over time? So that was, I was thinking about that, the terminology of that book, which again, I think is a fascinating book. And if people are interested in resilience, they should read it. But I don't know if it's a particularly American thing, or I think we have a way of thinking about resilience and talking about resilience colloquially as being unaffected. And as I talk about it in the book, like I think of it as the Teflon phenomenon, right? That nothing sticks to us. Things just kind of bounce off. And I don't think that's a realistic or helpful way to think about resilience, particularly for clinicians, because, you know, if we use that definition, then most people who come into us who are suffering or struggling don't look very resilient. And yet most or many of them have survived and adapted to, you know, very inhospitable circumstances in their lives. And, you know, when you look closely, they've done pretty amazing things despite. So I think that's what I mean. And I think also that, you know, invulnerability suggests a certain rigidity, I think, and how we talk about resilience, you know, suggests a certain rigidity and unaffectedness. And I think resilience, we talk about bouncing back, and I think of a bamboo, you know, something that's flexible. I think that resilience has to include flexibility, which I think means being affected, but it also means being able to recover.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there something about the AEDP approach that makes it particularly suited for resilience?
Yes, I think so. I think it's AEDP is a natural way of approaching people with a resilience-oriented lens. You know, we talk about in AEDP, I think it's kind of built into AEDP as an appreciation for being on the lookout for people's strengths and capacities, even when they're coming in the very beginning, and when the focus seems to be on their symptoms and defenses and how they're struggling and so forth. But, you know, we use language in AEDP, like trying to access what we call the self at best, you know, which is our capacity to be open, in touch with ourselves, realistic about others, responsive in ways that are realistic about the capacities of those relationships and our own capacities, to work with what we call the self at worst, you know, kind of maybe more typically the more shut down or the more defended aspect or manifestations of the self. So we're in AEDP, we're kind of always looking for that self at best, even from the beginning, you know, what is the best that someone is capable of in terms of their functioning, in terms of their relational capacity, and kind of appreciating that and appreciating what people have survived and how they've adapted to try to survive certain circumstances. So I think it's a very natural fit.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's what I'm hearing and what you're saying is it's not either or. It's not either we're a wreck or, you know, we're strong and going forward, but that those forces, if you will, are always active within us to some degree.
Yes.
Or another.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's a more humane way of thinking about and approaching human beings.
Yeah.
I just think that, like, I don't think of resilience as meaning that there is no, quote, damage, if we want to use that kind of language.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, that when there's damage or when there are symptoms and struggles, that there's not also resilience. I don't think of them as mutually exclusive at all.
Right. In fact, the main title of your book is Restoring Resilience. Mm-hmm. And the word restoring suggests that we start out resilient.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm aware, and I don't know this research very much, but I'm sure there's plenty of genetic research on, you know, what used to be called hardiness and things like that, and even now resilience. I'm sure there's some kind of genetic component and factor. I have three kids, so I feel like, you know, we all come into the world differently and, like, with different capacities and tolerances and stuff like that. So I think there is probably something to that, but I think, you know, again, it's kind of existential or metaphysical that I think we're born with a capacity to be on behalf of ourselves. And that's the other way I really think of resilience, is that all resilient processes are the ways in which we're on behalf of ourselves. And we're either on behalf of ourselves in ways that are more conservation of energy, kind of self-protective, closed, you know, oriented, self-protective, or we can be on behalf of ourselves in kind of more open, vulnerable, you know, permeable types of ways. And I think it's our experiences that shape largely which way we go, you know, how we learn to be on behalf of ourselves, whether we need to rely more on defenses and kind of more closed self-protective ways of being, or whether we feel free to kind of be open and permeable and take risks.
That's a really interesting phrase, being on behalf of ourselves. I've not encountered that before, but it's very clear.
Thank you.
Yeah. You have a number of case histories and sample therapist-patient dialogues in the book, and mm-hmm. I didn't get the impression that all had suffered what generally would be considered major trauma. And I guess up to this point, I've always thought of the word resilience as being related to trauma, you know, to heavy-duty trauma. And mm-hmm. so that makes me wonder if you see resilience as the lens for psychotherapy generally, and not just for those suffering from trauma.
Yes, I think I do. Yeah, I don't think of it just out within the context of trauma. I mean, it in many ways is probably most relevant in the context of talking about trauma. But I guess my experience is that probably most of the people that I've seen in psychotherapy over 20-something years, is there's some level of trauma, right? It's for some people, it's big T and maybe a lot of big T trauma. For others, it's a number of accumulated small T. For some, it's relational. For some, it's not. But I think our capacity to kind of adapt and how we take care of ourselves is relevant for everybody.
Yeah, this actually is something I heard from another interviewee pretty recently, who also felt that probably we all are traumatized in various mm-hmm. ways to one degree or another. Mm-hmm. And so I can see how that makes sense. A key theme that runs throughout your book is the focus, and this has been forecast and what you've said already, is to focus on the client's strengths, emphasizing the positive as much as possible rather than focusing on the pathology, which is not to say that you deny the pathology.
Right. Yeah. Yes, I feel very careful about that because I think we're, you know, I think there are, and I'm not super familiar with them, but there are kind of more purely strengths-based approaches that I think AEDP is not. I think we're very...
Well, for example, people who are into coaching have drawn heavily from the strengths thing, and they would not be, qualified, really, to go deeply into the psychopathology.
Right. And yes, and I think so from that perspective, the concepts I mentioned earlier about the idea of you accessing this kind of self at best to work on behalf of the self at worst, right? So that part of what we're doing is accessing people's real capacities, in part to develop self-compassion for the parts of themselves that struggle, mm-hmm. and that really get stuck. And that, building that intra-relationship between those parts of themselves, but also that we're really actively working with the places that have been traumatized, the parts that are stuck, the ways in which people are kind of stuck in more defensive modes of dealing with the world, and ultimately want to help people integrate and understand what that's about, so that, in the end, we're really trying to get to the creation of a coherent, cohesive life narrative that's born from this back and forth between having experiences and reflecting on those experiences. So there's a lot of emphasis on the positive, and my hope was that the book would appeal to depth-oriented psychologists who are looking for or developing ways of being either more active or kind of moving beyond maybe just the relationship and pre-associative kind of techniques, who are wanting to still do deep work, but who are wanting to learn some more kind of modern ways of approaching that. Mm-hmm. And I think that the depth-oriented psychologists can get a lot from understanding the need for working with the positive and positive affect and working with people's strengths kind of on behalf of themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I really resonated with the emphasis on the positive because I'm somebody who was long identified with the humanistic psychology and human potential movements. And I looked into the index in your book to see if perhaps there was a mention of humanistic psychology. I didn't find it, but I did see the references to Martin Seligman and positive psychology, which, while not the same thing, it has some of that same impulse that humanistic psychology had.
Right, right. Yes, I feel like, I think that's just an oversight, honestly. I feel like Rogers is very much there in the background for me, that capacity to be present, to witness, to listen carefully and deeply, to reflect the person back to themselves is just incredibly important.
And you also mentioned Eugene Gendlin in the book, and that you, who I would put in that camp of humanistic-oriented psychotherapy, and I noted that you are trained in that approach. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you want to say anything more about that or how that articulates with AEDP. I guess the experiential part, really, it would build on that.
The experiential part. And it's, I think of, I've not thought about this so specifically, but I think of Gendlin's work as, and it's similar to EMDR in my mind in terms of the practice, in terms of what's happening. But I think it really taps into more right brain ways of processing, so it's imagistic, it's feeling based, it's associative, without being, too heady or cognitive. And it really invites people into the body and, noticing kind of, for example, what issue feels most alive to them, right? So that they're learning to kind of tune into their own intuition and their own way of knowing themselves. I think that's, in a way, kind of basic in AEDP, and that's what we're doing a lot, but maybe we're doing it more explicitly through the relationship, right? Where I think, Gendlin, you can learn focusing. So, focusing. You can learn focusing.
Basically tuning into your body and being aware of what's emerging moment to moment, right?
Right, moment to moment, and just kind of tracking what comes up, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I think that people can be trained to do that for themselves, which is wonderful, wonderful thing to be able to do with yourself. And in AEDP, I think we're doing that a lot, but we're doing that dyadically. So the therapist is doing that with the patient, and to some extent, the patient is doing that with the therapist.
Yeah, now you mentioned EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprogramming, and you also have been trained in that, and I think I have a very simplistic impression of EMDR, and I keep encountering it more and more from people who find it to be of value in the work that they do, and I'm just sort of got this moving a finger in front of the eyes, and
right.
So how does that fit in to what you're doing?
I know there are some people who really think of themselves as primarily EMDR therapists and who bring everything into EMDR, which I don't know EMDR well enough to do that, but also, you know, my home base is AEDP. So I think of and use EMDR more as a tool. Mm-hmm. And especially when people are either very, very anxious and we're not kind of getting to places of being able to calm down, or there's just trauma that we're just not getting to in the normal way. So it's just something to throw in and experiment with. But I think what both approaches do very well is to elicit an affective experience. I've hardly ever done EMDR with somebody who hasn't had some kind of breakthrough of some feeling that maybe they haven't been able to get to at some time. And I think also similarly to focusing, there's, you know, because it's very free flowing in a way. I also think of EMDR as like free association with feeling. That's kind of how I think of EMDR, free association with feeling. So that there's some affective experience, which is what we really privilege a lot in AEDP, but there's also this emphasis on integration, you know, so the idea of, you know, either the eye movements, or now they have tappers, or people can listen to tones in their ears. This bilateral stimulation is presumably stimulating the left brain and the right brain so that people are integrating experiences from a more cognitive place, a more cognitive linear kind of logical place, and then from a more imagistic, more feeling-based place. And we talk a lot about, you know, left and right brain processing in AEDP.
Okay. Going back to the positive, you talk a little about your struggle as a student to find a balance between the pathological diagnostic perspective associated with psychoanalytic thinking and the strengths perspective. And I really identified with that because I struggled with that quite a bit as a graduate student in a very psychodynamically oriented program, which sent me scurrying to looking into all these other approaches,
right,
like gestalt therapy and focusing and all sorts of things. So maybe you can say a little bit more about the balance you found between those two.
I think I'm actually in the middle of finding the balance.
It never quite goes away. It gets totally resolved.
Away. Exactly. Well, I also, you know, I spent 6 years writing a book about resilience, which is presumably in the area of positivity. And I think from that, I and maybe it's aging and maturity and having done this for long enough, that I wouldn't say I'm more interested in the pathological, but there's part of me that kind of is, right? That I've also had, you know, many patients with whom I've worked with for many years. And I think the understanding of the depth of the psyche and relationships, I think, is kind of unparalleled in terms of its articulation in psychodynamic or psychoanalytic mm-hmm. theory. And there's so much promise, it feels to me, in relational psychoanalysis, where it really seems to allow or invite the therapist to be more present and authentic. So I feel like I get the positive piece pretty well, and have never lost sight of the more pathology focused part. But I think as I'm maturing, I'm kind of more interested in understanding a little bit more in depth about the pathological pieces and really how people get stuck.
I've seen that same kind of migration of attitude being here in California, Northern California, where a lot of the alternative stuff was right. born, and people were very experimental. But I've seen a lot of people in their training as they got older, as they became therapists, went back to school or back into supervision to learn the psychodynamic thinking because they came to a place where they felt like that depth was missing.
Yeah.
It kind of bottomed out too early.
Right, right. Yes, I think so. And I've always been interested in the depth. It just feels there's so much to learn. I mean, human beings are endlessly fascinating and I think endlessly complicated. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we're ever really done.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned something about in relational psychoanalysis, the importance of the therapeutic relationship. And I'm wondering, what is the therapeutic relationship like in EADP? Is that something that you folks talk about? Do you wrestle with the classical psychodynamic issues such as the therapeutic alliance, resistance, transference, therapist self-disclosure? So you can just kind of free associate to all of that.
Yeah.
That's a big question.
I'm not having an experience. I'm going to free associate. We talk a lot about, I should have said about some of the AEDP fundamentals. One of the biggest fundamentals is that what we talk about, trying to establish from the beginning a secure therapeutic relationship secure therapeutic relationship, kind of adopting from attachment theory and that attachment theory lens, right? That the idea that as children and any of us in relationships, intimate relationships, that we open up more, we explore more, we take more chances when we feel safe enough. So that's a huge emphasis in AEDP, is kind of building that connection so that it feels deep and tight and safe enough for people to do their own exploration. So I think that's how we would define the quote therapeutic alliance. Mm-hmm. I think there's less use of terms like resistance or transference. I think in AEDP language, we would kind of put those in the realm of resistance. We would use the term defense, defenses, people's ways of protecting themselves and kind of staying with the status quo. And I think transference is probably a mix in our language of defenses and anxiety. And I think in terms of therapist self-disclosure, this is probably one of the biggest, although again, I wonder how much this is maybe changing in relational psychoanalysis, but there's always been a lot more freedom I have felt. And I think it's one of the things that drew me to AEDP, to use myself in the room explicitly with my empathy or my appreciation for people and how they've come through things and their own strengths and sharing the impact of them on me, so I've always felt quite a bit of freedom to do that in AEDP with, judiciously, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's not so taboo.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you mentioned attachment theory, which you've got a chapter or two on attachment theory in the book. And it seems like that's really in the limelight today with we're learning things in neuroscience of how attachment theory kind of seems to map well onto some of the neurological processes that are being explored in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And you also reference Stephen Porges and his polyvagal theory. How does that fit in with the work you're doing?
I think Stephen Porges' work is amazing. And he also is a lovely guy.
I had the privilege of interviewing him as well. Yeah. I experienced him that way as well.
Very, really lovely. I think Diana discovered him at some point and started talking about him and his work. And so when I was researching the book, I read a number of his articles, and this was, I think, mostly before his book came out, his most recent book came out. But I think that the polyvagal theory of emotion gives us a language for both what happens in trauma and also what happens in healing relationships. So it kind of encapsulates both, but it really helps us understand neurologically what we see, you know, happening sometimes in session, what our patients report to us, what happens to them during traumatic incidents, right, where they can kind of either get, quote, triggered and be in some kind of fight mode, right, where the sympathetic nervous system is kind of ramped up, or, you know, this dorsal, what he talks about, the dorsal vagal response, where people are shut down, really kind of shut down in more of a kind of a collapse freeze mode. And they almost can't make use of the relational resources that they may have available to them. So I think he gives us a way of understanding what we see, what we've seen clinically, and also a way of understanding what happens when things go right, you know, when people don't have to lapse into either fight or freeze, and that what they're doing is using others in social relationships to help them regulate. And we talk a lot about, in AEDP, the therapist being a secure attachment figure so that the patient can use the therapist when they're feeling overwhelmed or too much to help them regulate themselves. And we talk also a lot, we've always talked about, or what we emphasize in training people to do AEDP is a lot about voice and prosody and eye contact and ways of being present and using our presence to help people regulate. And so I think he explains that very well through the social engagement system, right? That we're wired to do that as mm-hmm. well, and to mm-hmm. remain, even in the face of stress or adversity, to remain safe enough to kind of deal, because we feel supported and connected.
And you also emphasize that the therapists should develop their own resilience. And what's the relationship there between the therapist having developed their resilience and being a good therapist?
It's funny because I feel like we're in this kind of unique field where, at least among ourselves, we kind of joke about all these crazy therapists, right? So many people come into the field with many wounds of their own and not always the most mentally healthy or stable people in the world. But I think,
we're often the butt of jokes and humor TV and movies and so on.
Yeah. maybe we don't fight back very effectively, but that might be part of it. But I think that I recently was reading Jeffrey Kotler, who's written like tons of books. He wrote a book called On Being a Therapist, and he talks about the complementarity between our personal selves and our professional lives, and kind of because of that tight link, in a way, that the choice to be involved in helping the mental health of other people is a choice to improve our own. I think we're just more effective the more balanced we are, you know, the more we know how to take care of ourselves. But also not just taking care of ourselves, but like the more expanded our own capacities are. I think especially in doing something like AEDP, or, you know, depth-oriented, affectively-oriented approaches, when you're helping people get in touch with very deep emotion, in my experience, that's kind of threatening to most of us as we start out. You know, we have the feeling of can we hold them in this space? You know, can we tolerate it? And I do think that we, through exposure and through doing it and through surviving it and finding that it really is helpful to the patient, we grow, you know, our own capacity to be able to hold and manage and regulate ourselves and help regulate other people expands exponentially.
There's another four-letter therapeutic approach that's very close to what you're doing, and I'm blocking on it, maybe intense, is it IADP, or it's based on the work of Davin Liu?
ISTDP,
right, alphabet soup.
Right.
It seemed very similar in its intention.
Yes, it is.
And many of the approaches, I think.
ISTDP is where Diana Focia did her initial training for a number of years with Davin Liu.
Okay.
And
interesting.
Is that part of, this is kind of a number of years into the game. I can't speak for ISTDP. I have quite a bit of exposure, but is never officially trained in it. So AADP kind of broke off from ISTDP and remained connected to some extent. I think that at least initially, and it's very interesting how we all begin to converge on a point, right, over time and with experience.
Yeah,
we find the same truths, interestingly. Mostly the therapeutic relationship, I think, looks a little bit different and AADP tends to be much more explicitly empathic and kind of appreciative and affirmative of the patient in order to establish safety and connection and to trust that one can do deep work with that basis of safety and connection. Whereas ISTDP, at least in its origins, was much more kind of confrontational.
They really go directly at the defenses.
Right.
And the big commonality, I think, is the agreement that of a corrective emotional experience, if you will,
yes.
Right?
That's a big commonality, right? Whereas in AADP, we tend to try to bypass defenses as much as possible and keep inviting people into their experience.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Without the defenses, if that makes sense.
And I'm interested that you and I guess Diana use the goal of therapy or of resilience therapy as transformance rather than transformation. Was that a coined word? I don't think I had encountered the word transformance before.
Transformance is a term that that Diana coined in 2008 or 2009 to give language to what I think other people have also tried to talk about and articulate over time in various theories and approaches, but which is she's defined it as the orientation or the striving and the openness to, I'm not being precise about it, development and healing and growth that happens both in therapy and outside of therapy and other relationships. So it really is the opposite of resistance, right? Whereas resistance is kind of sticking with what's known and comfortable and resisting growth for the sake of safety, usually.
So this would be more of a growth drive?
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh.
Growth and development.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think to clarify that it's not that transformation is not a goal of the therapy. It certainly is, but I think what you may be referring to in the book is that I'm talking about the way in which I've defined resilience is that the process of therapy hopefully helps people express resilience if we're understanding it as their way of being on behalf of themselves. Less through resistance, you know, through this kind of more conservation-oriented way of being in the world, and more through transformance. So people who can kind of absorb and respond to adversity or challenge with a certain amount of openness, with the capacity to feel what they're feeling, to reach out to healthy relationships and things like that.
And towards the end of the book, you've got a chapter on fear and trembling in relation to transformance. What's going on there? What's this fear and trembling?
I borrowed the term from, I think it's the title of one of Kierkegaard's books, right. Which is really, it's been a year since I've read it, but parts of it are very beautiful. And I think he captures, and I don't know how to explain it beyond this, other than it seems fairly true of human beings, that, you know, when we are on the precipice of great change, it's just a lot to absorb. And we have tend to respond to that with some level of anxiety. In AEDP, we talk a little bit about what we call tremulous affect, so that in the, we've noticed that when people experience big change, there's always a moment where there's some anxiety. And it's not an inhibitory anxiety. It's not an anxiety that's intending to kind of shut down the process. But it's more kind of that feeling of like, wow, I'm just about to do this, you know, this big thing, and I can hardly believe it, you know. And I think that's, you know, Piaget talked about assimilation and accommodation, right? I always reverse which one is which, but that as we're about to accommodate, probably it's something very new, that many people experience anxiety at some level, and it can even be fear-inducing. So a lot of times people will say, patients will say, this feels really weird. You know, weird is a common mm-hmm. word, I think. Sometimes they'll say, this feels really new, and maybe it brings up self-doubt. I don't know that I can do this. It's clear to me that I need to do this, whatever the this is, but I don't know that I can, you know. So that kind of experience of having to make room in the self for the expansion of the self, or the expansion of the self's capacities, it's big. It's a sense of bigness.
Huh. That sort of makes me think of people who lose a lot of weight somehow and then have to adjust their self-image, and it feels weird to them.
Yes. That's a great example, actually, I think. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, as we wind down, I wonder if there are other thoughts that you'd like to get out before we say goodbye.
Nothing really that I can think of. It's been a pleasure talking with you. I hope people are interested in the book.
Yeah.
It's a work of love.
Yeah. And people who are interested in this approach, how would they get training and so on? You guys actually have a training institute, right?
Very much right, yes. The AEDP has a website called the AEDPinstitute.com, and there's a little tab in there if you go through, and you can look for trainings and look for workshops. We're kind of all over. I mean, it's international at this point. There's usually a number of introductory workshops that take place during the, you know, in different places in the United States during the year. Immersion course is the first course, and then people take more advanced courses beyond that. But there's tons of information there. And also about small communities that have developed in different parts of the country.
Small communities, did you say?
Yeah, small communities of AEDP therapists, or people who are studying AEDP.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Dr. Eileen Russell, I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Wow, what an alphabet soup of therapeutic approaches there are out there. In this interview, we heard not only about AEDP, but also ISTDP and EMDR. I wonder how many others like that there are out there. EFT also comes to mind, and I'm sure there must be more. It would be nice if innovators could come up with some nice short names like focusing. But I guess it's not always possible to come up with a one or two word name that's sufficiently descriptive and distinctive. All that aside, the thing that surprised me most about Dr. Russell's book is that she extends the concept of resilience so far beyond its common usage. However, as she shared with us, She spent 3 years researching and developing her ideas in the writing of this book. It's extremely authoritative. You will learn not only about resilience, but also a lot about AEDP. There is thorough coverage of the relevant neuroscience, and she goes into depth on attachment theory. As I mentioned in the interview, there are a number of sample therapist-patient transcripts in the book that are illustrative of her way of working. I probably should have asked her to read one of those for us. This book is especially recommended for clinicians who wish to take a psychodynamic approach that combines depth with an emphasis on client strengths and positive resources. Aside from all that, I must say I found Dr. Eileen Russell to be very personable and open. I enjoyed this opportunity to speak with her. Clearly, she's one of the pioneers of our field. The title of the book, again, is Restoring Resilience, Discovering Your Client's Capacity for Healing by Eileen Russell. As usual, if you decide to order this book, I encourage you to use the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar on our website.
Hi, Dave. It's Heiko from Germany. I work in a violence counseling center as a psychologist and psychotherapist in Düsseldorf, and I graduated from university more than 20 years ago. So I'm always on the lookout for new perspectives and new developments in psychotherapy and psychology. And so I discovered your Wise Counsel podcasts several years ago. And it made me feel like I was sitting in the lecture hall in university again. And I liked it very much. I decided to follow your Shrink Wrap Radio podcast. And when a topic comes along that it seems of interest to me, like recently Dr. Rumanier on deliberate practice, I listen to it, and mostly I very much enjoy it. And so I think it's only decent if I like it that I contribute to the cost and reward your efforts you have with it. You offer this guilt-free option. It's only $12 a year. I mean, it's almost nothing. So I decided to rid myself of my guilt and be decent and pay something for the enjoyment you give me with your podcasts. Thank you very much for your efforts, and I hope you will keep them coming.
Thank you, Heiko from Germany. I appreciate your encouraging others to become donors. I'm afraid we have no new donors since the last episode, though, even at the very low guilt-free level that Heiko mentioned. But hope springs eternal. It's been a while since I've mentioned Audible.com, my favorite way of reading books these days. I've been an Audible subscriber, it seems like forever, in a good way. I've got a recommendation for a great companion piece to today's interview. The title is Option B, Facing Adversity, Building Resilience, and Finding Joy by Sheryl Sandberg. As you may know, she's the chief operating officer of Facebook, who also famously wrote a book titled Lean In. What you may not know is after the sudden death of her husband, she went into profound despair, fearing she'd never find her way back again. A psychology professor at the Wharton School of Business gave her tools that helped her bounce back. If you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if that's not to your taste, they now have more than 250,000 titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is Eileen Russell, clinical psychologist and author of the book Restoring Resilience, Discovering Your Client's Capacity for Healing. And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Well, of course, that was today's guest, Dr. Eileen Russell. Now let's dip into our listener email basket. I'll read just one today, and it's from Frank Z in Germany, who responds to my note of thanks for becoming a donor. And I refer to him as Frank Z because I don't want to take a chance on pronouncing his last name again, which I butchered previously. He writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, considering the huge amount of high-quality podcasts you share with us for free, it's just a small donation. After all these years, I enjoy the inspiring and insightful conversations. In fact, your podcast caused a, quote, second spring of passion for high-quality psychotherapy. Since this year, I've started my sixth education in another therapeutic approach, psychodynamic psychotherapy. It is so refreshing to listen to you and your guests discovering new approaches to help people. In times where therapeutic treatments are more and more seen or requested as an applied science, where everything must be standardized and evidence-based, it is a refreshing relief to find a podcast where therapy is viewed as a creative art and an encounter of unique human beings. As my former professor Jürgen Kreis wrote, everyone demands that therapy should be scientific, but nobody asks whether scientific is therapeutic. I go with Milton Erickson, who said that it is required to create a new form of therapy that fits the needs and characteristics of each unique client. But science wants to create only one way of therapy for all patients. In Germany, there's a strong tendency that only behavioral therapy is taught at the universities and promoted as the only reputable and helpful therapeutic approach. At the same time, this approach silently annexes techniques and methods of the other approaches, selling them as, quote, new wave, close quote, or a new way of behavioral therapy. That is very sad and bitter. So I also love that you have a huge variety of different guests, not just professors, doctors, but also artists, former patients, alternative healers, and so on. Another main thing I enjoy and learn a lot from your podcast, I admire your empathic, patient, aware, and wise attitude with which you lead the interviews. By carefully listening, I learn a lot about how to create a respectful, secure space where people can open up and share their sensitive thoughts, beliefs, and feelings. I hope that you will stay healthy and enthusiastic so that we will enjoy your podcast for many years. Again, thank you so much for your precious work. With best regards. And again, that's from Frank Z. Well, Frank, thank you so much for your high praise. It really energizes me and it makes my day. The situation is much the same here in the U.S. that almost all universities teach only cognitive behavioral therapy, as if there were not other valid alternatives. So that's part of my motivation for doing Shrink Wrap Radio, to expose professionals, students, and potential clients all over the world to the fact that there are many alternatives to choose from. And today's interview with Dr. Russell is a good example of that. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up once again for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks again to today's guest, Dr. Eileen Russell, for so generously sharing her work on resilience and AEDP. Next week, my return guest will be Dr. Louis Cozzolino, and we'll be discussing the third edition of his groundbreaking book, The Neuroscience of Psychotherapy. So I sure hope you'll join us for that one. And until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.